Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for February 11th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, we focus on data. First up, whether and how to release personal genomic data. Then, making climate data available to non-climate scientists. And finally, the world's capacity to store, communicate, and compute information. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about comparing photographs with paintings of presidents from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Technology is making it faster, easier, and less expensive to sequence people's DNA. And geneticists are studying not just a gene here or there, but sets of genes, chromosomes, even whole genomes. As scientist Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue, that's presenting some ethical dilemmas as researchers struggle with whether and how to share genetic information with people, even if they signed up for a study in order to get it.
So you're a researcher, you're running a clinical trial testing a new treatment for childhood leukemia. You have a little boy who's in this trial with the disease, and you happen to find out that, genetically speaking, he's at a high risk of relapsing with leukemia. That information doesn't have any effect on the treatment that he gets now, and you have to decide whether to share this with the parents. The story deals with what's becoming a really big issue in genetic research. Right now, the technology has changed so much that the way that we conduct genetic studies allows for much more extensive sequencing of DNA. So scientists used to go in and look at a very particular spot in the genome and say, I want to look here for, say, a heart disease gene. Now they're just sequencing large chunks of the genome in a way that they couldn't do before. And as sort of a side effect of that, there's a chance that they might find things they're not looking for genetically about the people in the study. So they could find in a heart disease study that someone happens to be at a high risk of breast cancer, maybe someone has a sex chromosome abnormality, maybe someone carries different genetic mutations that could lead to them having children with a certain genetic disease. There are all sorts of things that can come up, and there's really no consensus right now on what to do with this information, when to share it with research participants, and how to share it.
When people sign up to be participants in these genetic studies, what, if anything, does the contract say about sharing genetic results with study participants?
That's evolving. Right now, the informed consent form that people go over before they agree to participate generally says that they're not going to get any information back. So it says you're giving up your DNA for a study into diabetes genes or whatever, but that's it. We're not giving you back information. And it's pretty clear. There are a few exceptions to this, but that's generally how it works now.
You mentioned a scenario about relapse or having a genetic predisposition for relapse for leukemia. So these are the types of circumstances that are prompting researchers to essentially break the contract if the contract signed didn't include sharing any of the information?
I think it's a really difficult situation right now, and this is just starting because the technology that is making these discoveries happen is just on the cusp of being widely used. So there haven't been too many cases yet that have come up, and it's still relatively rare that researchers will, quote-unquote, break that contract, that informed consent form that says we're not giving you back information. In general, they've done this in cases where there's a very immediate health implication to the information, and giving that information might change how the person is treated. So one example here that's often mentioned is one of the breast cancer genes called BRCA1. And women who carry certain mutations in that gene have a really high risk of breast cancer and also a really high risk of ovarian cancer. And at the same time, if they know that they have those mutations, they can have extra surveillance, they can have their breasts and ovaries surgically removed to reduce their risk of cancer. And many women who carry BRCA1 mutations have done that. So if you happen to be doing a study and come upon this, discover that a woman who's participating in this genetic study is BRCA1 positive, many researchers do think it makes sense to share that information because there's something that that woman can really do about it.
So what's the concern when people sign up for a study in which they do want and will get the results?
Well, I think the concern is there are a lot of gray areas here in terms of what is worth sharing, and there's just a lot of disagreement about it. So some of the more straightforward concerns are legal concerns. The way that the DNA is sequenced in these genetic studies is actually quite different, or is done in different labs, I should say, than the way that it's sequenced for clinical work. So if you go into a hospital and you're getting a genetic test for something that your doctor has ordered, that DNA is sequenced in a clinically approved lab. DNA research studies don't often use those labs, and there is some question whether those results can even be returned to people without being validated in a clinical lab. So there are some legal issues there that people are still arguing about. Then there's also the question of whether people even want this information. So in the story, I mentioned a case that was from a while ago, about 10 years ago, in which a geneticist was working with a family in a research study, and their daughter had unexplained mental retardation and other problems, and they had enrolled in the study to look at her chromosomes and determine whether there were any deletions in her DNA that could explain what was wrong with her. And they did find a deletion, and the geneticist shared this with the parents. And to his surprise, the father in particular was extremely upset by the news, even though the family had enrolled their daughter in the study knowing that this was the goal of the study. And this reminded him, and it could also serve to remind others, that first of all, people may enroll in studies for all sorts of reasons. This family may have enrolled in the study because they wanted researchers to tell them that their daughter could be cured when what they found suggested she couldn't be. And in general, people may not really know what they want until the results are put in front of them. So even when we run focus groups and we study this as best we can, in some cases we're always operating under assumptions about how participants in research will react, and that's something that geneticists need to keep in mind as they go forward.
Beyond anecdotes, is there any data out there about how people react when they get news that they have some genetic reason or increased risk for some disease?
There is some data. It's hard to design studies so that they really reflect these scenarios, but the data that's out there suggests so far that people tend to do well and they tend to want this information. For example, there's been a fair amount of work going on for several years at Boston University looking at how people respond when they find out that they carry a gene variant that puts them at a high risk of Alzheimer's disease. But again, those are people who've signed up for that study. They know they might be getting that information back. They're expecting it. They're the kinds of people who would seek out genetic information. People who might be, you know, interested in helping researchers learn more about type 2 diabetes may not be the kinds of people who want to know whether they have some abnormality in their sex chromosomes or carry, you know, genes for a childhood disease. And so that's the struggle. It's hard to mimic these situations in research studies, but people are certainly trying to do that.
At this point, then, are there any official guidelines for whether, and if so, how, to share genetic information with study participants?
There aren't really any official guidelines. There have been some guidelines proposed, but they're not really set firmly in place. One exception, though, is that Spain a few years ago passed a law actually requiring that information that has a real effect on someone's health who's in a genetic study be shared, even if it just has an effect on their biological family members, that it be shared. And again, because this technology is still pretty new, it doesn't sound as though that law has had a big practical impact, but it certainly could in the next few months and years.
Are there efforts underway then to find some universal standards for sharing genetic information?
There are definitely efforts underway to find some standards. Whether they'll be universal, I think, is still a question. But people are working on that. There was a group of researchers who were convened by the U.S. National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute to look into this, to find standards. Other people are working on what biobanks might do here. Biobanks often have hundreds of thousands of samples of people's DNA and present a particularly difficult circumstance for giving back results from genetic studies. So people are working on that as well.
So it's not necessarily that a particular geneticist doing a study and the geneticist's institution review board that decides whether to approve the study, that they're going to be on their own in terms of deciding whether to share results or not.
I think it's hard to say. I mean, right now they are. That's how it's working now, is someone would go back to their institutional review board or their institution and they would say, should I share this? They would talk to their collaborators. And that kind of situation may continue for a while. I think most people are wary of having laws in place. So even if you have guidelines, there are so many different ways that this can play out that, you know, the guidelines can help, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to also seek guidance from your institution and ethicists who you've been working with and others to help you figure out what to do in a particular case.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue on the ethical decisions geneticists are facing as they decide whether, and if so, how, to share genetic information with study participants, even when they have signed up for the study to get it. Climate scientists take data from a wide variety of sources, including ice cores, tree rings, corals, rocks, caves, old ships' logs, and satellites. Then they use the data both to design and validate computer models, first checking the model's predictive power against the past records, and then extrapolating out to the future. These models themselves in turn generate even more data, giving, for example, an estimate of the amount of rainfall in San Francisco, as well as every other city on the planet, for the next 50 years. And there are dozens of different models with various data as inputs, computing with different formulas and methods, and of course, producing different outputs, different predictions for the future climate, with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change incorporating many of these models to make its assessments. As David Easterling and colleagues write in a perspective in this week's Science, there are a lot of challenges for climate data in the coming century, particularly as an increasing number of people want to access it, from resource managers to engineers to policy and decision makers. I spoke with Easterling from his office at the National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina.
The amount of climate data is rapidly increasing. It's actually exploding. And we need to be able to come up with methods that allow us to take that data and make it usable not only to the science community, but also to decision makers and even the general public.
Are you and your co-authors drawing a distinction between challenges to the data itself, the veracity or use of the data, and distinguishing that from challenges, say, in the amount of data or distribution of it, getting various data sources to match up in modeling the climate?
Right. That's sort of two ends to the same issue, because we have huge amounts of climate data, both from observational networks, in situ networks on land, satellites, reanalyses, which are these sort of hybrid model observational-based data sets, as well as climate model data. And then you extend that to the fact that we have these huge amounts of data, they're very complex, and we need the ability, we need systems that will allow us to query the data, make products from these data that are useful for not only the climate science community, but also to other science communities that use these data in their research and for decision makers and even the general public.
So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its assessments of the climate, that isn't providing people, other scientists, other scientific communities with what they want or need?
Not when you drill down to some of the specialized needs that a lot of these communities have. A good example would be people that are building infrastructure for storm sewers or dams and that sort of thing. You know, these are civil engineers and people with waterworks. And one of the big issues that we've seen in terms of the observed climate is that we've seen increases in heavy rainfall events. Well, they need that information extended into the sort of products that they use to design a dam. You know, how much more rainfall are we going to get? So how much bigger do they need to design that dam, or how much bigger do they need to design that storm sewer? So it's not just the climate science community, and it's not just the overall science community, but it's the users of these products as well that need access, either in a condensed form or in some cases they even want sort of the raw data to be able to use it in their own research and their own decision making.
Before we get to the raw data, just for the modeling and predicting, is there a climate model that has earned consensus within the scientific community, the climate science community, as one that non-climate scientists could use for their purposes of prediction?
Not quite sure where you're going with that one. If you look at the IPCC reports, there's a number of modeling groups that contribute simulations to the data bank. If you look at the CMIP-3 data bank that's actually mentioned in here, and the CMIP-5, which are the main modeling simulation data banks for the IPCC, a number of the major modeling groups all contribute simulations to it. And typically, you know, they provide a range of estimates of, say, how much warming we're going to see by the end of the 21st century. And that range does give you a measure of uncertainty because, you know, you can't say that there's one model that does everything perfectly well.
Sure. But for the scenario that you mentioned, for example, people wanting to figure out how big to make their sewer systems, they're going to be able to get that kind of thing out of a model? Or?
Well, we're actually at the National Climatic Data Center. We're taking a look at just that problem. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, puts out products that are used by civil engineers. These are basically an idea of what's the 5-year maximum amount of rainfall you would expect, let's say, with the probability of returning once every 5 years, sort of the 5-year return period, you know, very large rainfall that you would expect to happen only once every 5 years. And so if your design criteria is to say to meet the 5-year or even 50-year return period rainfall event, well, with climate change, if we're seeing and we expect more heavy rainfall events, we need to provide an estimate of how much more that 5-year rainfall event might be, say 50 years from now, because of climate change. And so one thing that we can do is we can take a look at the climate models and actually look at a range of them and say, all right, what sort of increase in heavy rainfall events do they project by the year, say, 2050 or 2060? And then we take that information, we can then incorporate it into the products that we're providing to these civil engineers, and they can then say, hey, you know, by 2050, instead of a 10-inch and 24-hour rainfall event, it may be a 15-inch and 24-hour rainfall event is sort of the maximum that you would expect. And so that's where we can take the climate model simulations along with the observational data and provide information for the user on how the climate might impact sort of, you know, the area that they're actually looking at.
To the data itself, as opposed to modeling, are there any impediments to getting the data, the raw, the processed, or even the climate modeling data?
That's a great question, because I deal mainly with the observational record, instrumental record of the past history of the climate system. And there are a couple of issues that we deal with. And one of those is that there are parts of the world where we don't have a lot of climate data, even though they may exist. A lot of the meteorological administration or the services for some of these countries feel like that some of the data that they hold are valuable in a monetary sense, and so they don't make them freely available. And so one of the issues is trying to convince these countries that, you know, in the name of climate science, they need to make these data freely available to the research community and to the general public so that we can get a better idea of the past history of the climate system. And then the second part of that is that there are still a lot of climate data that are in archives in paper form. Even here at the National Climate Act Data Center in Asheville, we have literally millions of records that are still either in paper form or we only have static images of them and they need to be put into digital form. And that would actually give us also kind of fill in some of these holes back in time that we have around the world so we can get a better picture of how temperature and rainfall have changed over, say, the past 120 or 30 years.
Even with that data digitized or freely available from countries around the world, it sounds as if to use that data appropriately, people should have a climate scientist on board. Is that the idea?
Well, I mean, to make maximum use of any kind of data, it's good to have an expert in that data. But one of the things that we're sort of advocating here is that you can have a climate scientist, for example, help sort of pre-process the data to put it into a form that it's sort of one step removed from the raw data, but it's in a form that, say, an ecologist could use or a plant scientist of some kind or even an economist could use to take a look at how climate change might impact with their particular problem. And then you can even make them a little bit more processed and make a system. You can set up a web system, for example, where you can take the data and you can provide tools that a decision maker can come in and say, hey, I'd like to see, you know, what's the projected climate for San Francisco in 2060 for temperature and give me how much it might warm and then sort of the range. And they can come in and use those tools and say, hey, you know, this gives us more information to make our decisions now, because if you're looking at infrastructure, it's a lot cheaper to make the changes to some sort of major infrastructure that's going to be lasting 50 to 100 years. A lot cheaper to make the change now in the design phase than it is to go back and retrofit something.
David Easterling, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Easterling of the National Climatic Data Center is senior author of a paper in this week's Science on the climate data challenges in the 21st century. Technologically speaking, 1986 was a long time ago. The Human Genome Project was just getting started. IBM released its first laptop computer, the PC Convertible, sporting two floppy drives and weighing less than 13 pounds. In 1986, programmers at Stanford University defined the first version of Internet Message Access Protocol, or IMAP, for a relatively new form of communication, email. over the next two decades, we transitioned more and more away from ink and paper, vinyl records, and analog magnetic tapes to digital technologies with optical drives, mobile phones, and a computer chip in every microwave. In a paper published online by Science, Martin Hilbert and Priscilla Lopez take an accounting of those two decades from 1986 to 2007 and measure the world's technological capacity to store, communicate, and compute information. I spoke with Hilbert from his office at the University of Southern California.
Well, these technologies are very important in our daily lives, in economic development and political freedoms, as we can see, and they change everything. So it's simply important to quantify that, because in a scientific sense, to measure is to know, right? And having these orders of magnitudes and being able to compare them with other orders of magnitudes, for example, how much information nature is usually handling compared to how much information we're handling in our technologies, that's a first very important, interesting thing to look at. And second of all, also to understand the rates of growth of our capacity to technologically process information and the rate of digitization, how fast we're digitizing our technological capacities, our information stock.
Previous researchers have done this before. Is your and your co-author Priscilla Lopez's study an update to those studies, or have you gone about it in a different way?
There are several innovations. First of all, our inventory is much larger than previous inventories. Second of all, in this we also include analog technologies, analog and digital technologies. And third of all, we do it in a time series. Previous studies basically maximally capture, track 3 consecutive years. We do it over 2 decades, so from 1986 to 2007. In order to be able to do that, to include analog and digital technologies, and to do time series studies, we also had to advance the methodologies. So previous studies basically measure the hardware capacity. They measure the amount of data that can be stored on hardware. We measure the amount of information. That means we normalize on compression rates. We act like all the data would be optimally compressed to its entropic level, and then we only measure what's the information, the pure information that is left. So there's also methodological innovation in this regard. And last but not least, we also expand the scope of the study. So previous studies measured how much information can be stored or communicated, and we also measure how much information can be computed. So that's a third whole different information operation that we add to it.
What counts as information?
That's a very interesting question, because when you think about it, right, you have, for example, a Word document and you store it on your hard disk. Let's say it's the size of 100 kilobits. Now you compress it and suddenly it only weighs 50 kilobits. So how much information is in this Word document? 100 kilobits, 50 kilobits? That can be quite confusing. So we follow the basic methodology of information theory, what Claude Shannon taught us more than 60 years ago. And basically what he taught us was, if you take information and you compress it to its uttermost compression rate, as far as you can compress it, that means you take all the redundancy out of the data, then you approach the entropy of this information source. So that's called the entropy, which is very similar to physical entropy, and that's the ultimate measure of information. So this is how we count information. That's the basic methodology behind it. So it's not the hardware capacity, not the data. We just see the kind of information that effectively reduces uncertainty.
What about paper and data stored on paper?
That is also included. We basically looked at how much paper is produced in the world and then estimated what information can be stored on this paper. That includes basically, we separated it into different categories. One is books and printing. The other one is advertisement and newspapers. So these are included in our information storage. We also include them in communication. For example, newspapers and advertising would make part of our inventory of broadcasting. Broadcasting, we define it as a one-directional information diffusion, in contrary to telecommunication, which is two-way communication. Postal letters would be part of telecommunication, of our inventory of telecommunication. So at the end, we have these broad categories, and we basically do not care if they are executed analogly or digitally. We put them together and normalize them on the optimal compression rate, which means we normalize them and measure their informational capacity.
And you also said that you had done something new this time compared with previous researchers in terms of scope, computation. What is it that you tracked in terms of computation then?
So in computation, there are basically two different kinds of computers that we are usually dealing with. The one is what you and me usually refer to as a computer, that is your PC, your mobile phone, a server, a supercomputer. Now there's also an entire other group of computers, which is, for example, the microcontrollers in your microwave or in your car, or the processor that controls your graphic display, your monitor. So there are these two groups. So we measured both of them, and it's very interesting to know, even so, the inventory of our second group of the application-specific computers was not as exhaustive. We simply wanted to show that the second group is much larger than the first group. So application-specific computers compute much more than general-purpose computers. In other words, computers by themselves compute much more than we compute with our computers.
So then with normalized data to store, communicate, and compute information, how do those compare with one another?
The interesting thing that we found is that usually when you think about the information age and the digital revolution, the first things that come to mind are the internet and mobile phone, because they are everywhere and we use them every day. Now, we found out that the information operation with the fastest growth rate has been the computation of information. So the world's technological capacity to compute information has grown at a rate at about 50 to 60% per year. That's around 9 times faster than the world economy is growing.
With most of the compute information being done by computers without our input, like microwaves, things like that.
That means to what you and me usually refer to as computers. If we would include all the microwaves, that would even be faster.
Okay.
On the other hand, our capacity to store information has also increased vastly, around 4 times faster than the economy is growing, at 23% per year. However, our combined technological capacity to communicate, that means the combined technological capacity to broadcast and to telecommunicate information together, has been pretty slow in comparison.
Now, you mentioned at the outset that both tracking and measuring the digitization and rate of growth were important. We've talked a little bit about the rate of growth. What about the rate of digitization?
The rate of digitization has been extremely fast, but it has been different in different sectors. For example, broadcasting is still in the analog age now. It is changing rapidly as digital television and digital radio is being introduced. That is also the reason why broadcasting has not grown as fast as others, because it's still pretty much analog. The fastest in the terms of digitization has been telecommunications. And right now, 99.9% of all information that is telecommunicated in a two-way communication is taking place through digital format. The 0.1% are the postal letters that we exchange and so forth. Now, the case of storage is very interesting in this sense, because there you can really see it. In the year 2000, not too long ago, still 75% of all the information that we were able to store in the world was stored on analog devices. So in the year 2000, 70% of the information that we could store was stored on these kind of like VHS-like cassettes. Only 2 years later, now in the year 2002, for the first time, we could store more information on digital technology than on analog technology. And in the year 2007, only 5 years later, already 94% of all the information that we store is stored on digital devices. So this process of digitization has been incredibly fast. In less than 10 years, we basically digitized our entire stock of information.
And what, if any, implications does all that growth have for science itself as a discipline?
Well, for us social scientists, you know, we are, as social scientists, we have been a little bit lagging in compared to other sciences. It turns out that information, especially in Shannon's sense, in a sense of entropy, is becoming one of the unifying variables of science. And we social scientists, we've been talking a lot about the digital age and the information society, and socially we are very aware, but we did not really walk the talk of the information age yet. We are just right now, and this study is a contribution, starting to measure how much information is processed by a social system, by an economy, by a cultural system, and so forth. So for social science, this is very important, because we have to start to put numbers to these theories and start to understand them. Now, for science as a whole, as information is becoming one of these unifying variables of science, maybe information is becoming the unifying variables of all science, it is interesting to make some comparisons. we are able to store 295 exabytes of information. Now, that's a number with 20 zeros. It's huge. However, compared to what physics do, it is very small. For example, there are much more stars in the universe than we are storing bits on planet Earth. For example, if you would like to give one distinct name to every star in the universe, these names would have to be 28 letters long, by the way, you would only be able to store the name of every 1,000 star in one of our technological devices. And that is, we would need all the paper that we have, all the video cassettes, all the x-rays, all hard disk, every little microchip on the back of your credit card, we would use to store nothing else than names of stars. And still, we would only be able to store the name of every 1,000 star, 999 stars out of 1,000. We could not even store their name. So compared to Mother Nature, we are but humble apprentices. However, technological evolution is incredibly fast. So while nature pretty much stays constant, it changes, but it changes very slow, our technological evolution grows at an exponential rate. That means, compared to Mother Nature, we are but humble apprentices, but we learn very fast. We can expect that by the mid of the century or by this end of the century, we will be able to store as much information on our technological devices as humankind is storing in its combined DNA. So it's interesting to see that we are at an age where we are slowly but surely approaching the orders of magnitudes that nature is working with.
Martin Hilbert, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Robert.
Martin Hilbert of the University of Southern California is lead author of a paper on the world's technological capacity to store, communicate, and compute information. Find it online, along with a collection of other articles about dealing with scientific data, at sciencemag.org/special/data. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about what George Washington really looked like. First President of the United States, Dave, don't we have portraits of him?
There are lots of portraits of him. In fact, there are so many representations of George Washington. He's even on our dollar bill. So George Washington is everywhere. But the one thing we don't have of George Washington is an actual photograph. So in all these portraits, we really have to take for granted that the artist's style accurately represented these pre-photography people.
So which artists are we looking at? Are we looking at portraits or sculpture or what?
Well, Rob, the artist the researchers focused on in this study was Gilbert Stuart, who was a very famous 19th century painter. He painted six of the American presidents and a lot of other famous individuals from his time. And the interesting thing about Gilbert Stuart is a few of the subjects that he painted, for example, President John Quincy Adams and Senator Daniel Webster, were actually alive during the time when photography had just been invented. So in addition to paintings we have that Stuart made, we actually also have real photographs of these men. And what the scientists wondered in this study is they said, well, can we use these painting photograph combinations as a sort of Rosetta Stone to figure out what Stuart's artistic style was? And then can we subtract that style from a lot of the early portraits of these famous men and get a better picture of what these guys actually look like?
So assuming that Stuart's style didn't change over the course of his life, subtracting away the style from George Washington's portrait.
Exactly. And what the researchers noticed when they started to look at these photographs and compared them with Stuart's paintings is that Stuart tended to give his subjects a bit fuller cheeks and he gave them higher eyebrows. Some really subtle things, but things that definitely marked his artistic signature. And what the researchers did was they fed these pictures and representations of these photographs into a computer. They created an algorithm that helped subtract out his style, and voila, they came up with what they say is a pretty close representation of George Washington and some other famous folks, including Washington's contemporary John Adams. And of course, you can see these pictures on the site.
So obviously, there had to be at least some extrapolation here because these photographs weren't taken at the same time as the portraits were painted, were they?
That's a good point, Rob. The person wasn't necessarily the same age in the photographs as he was in the painting, so it's not perfect. But what the researchers want to do is they really want to refine this method. And it's actually, as you can imagine, very, very difficult to track down these very early photographs. And they've actually set up a website, which you can also check out on the site, where people can submit very old photographs. And what this team is going to try to do is match these old photographs, especially if they're famous folks, obviously that makes it easier, to portraits and further refine their technique so that they can correct for things like age and really try to get as close as we're probably ever going to get to a photograph of these pre-photography people.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Robin, this next story, I've got a very cool physics trick for you that you can try next time you're at a party, or at least a party of science nerds.
What's the trick?
Well, Rob, take two tin cans, and one of them has no top or bottom, so it's essentially a tube, and the other one just has a top. Now take both of these cans and put them in a box of sand so that their bottom rims are right on top of the sand.
So the one that's not a tube, it's closed off at the top.
Exactly. Now what I want you to do, assuming you had some sand in front of you, is try to push both of these cans down at the same time. Just try to really shove them into the sand. And what you'll notice, rather surprisingly, is that the can with the top actually goes into the sand much easier than the tube. And you wouldn't expect that. You would expect all this sort of air pressure in the can with the top to be preventing you, sort of like a diving bell in the water would be preventing you from pushing it down. But actually, it has a much easier time of going in. And if you don't believe me, there's a video on the site. You can actually watch this happening.
So this is a party trick with a bunch of science geeks at a beach.
That's true. The beach would be the best place to do it.
So what's going on?
Well, Rob, it took a team of physicists to find out. They were actually the ones that came up with the trick in the first place, too. And what they found out after a lot of intense physical analysis was that what happens with the closed-ended cylinder is it affects the sand in a very unusual way. Ordinarily, sand acts very much like a solid. But if the air around the sand grains moves quickly enough, the sand starts to flow like a fluid. And so what the researchers are saying is happening with this trick is that the air that's trapped in this can with the top rushes out from beneath the cylinder's rim when you start to push it down into the sand, and it effectively fluidizes the sand. It turns the sand almost into a liquid, and you don't get that effect with the can that's just a tube. And therefore, the can with the top is actually meeting a lot less resistance and has a lot easier time sinking into the sand than the other can does.
Now, you said there was a video on the site, but I can imagine that there's going to be all kinds of people trying this out at beaches around the world. It works every time?
Well, Rob, you've got to set this up just right. The sand has to be pretty densely packed. And also, you've got to push these cans down very quickly. If you don't do that, the air will slowly seep away from the can with the top, and that'll essentially make it no different than the can that's the tube. So there are some conditions you've got to watch out for. But if you can get it right, chances are you're going to really impress your friends, at least if they're physics geeks.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from slamming cans into sand to slamming meteorites into dirt, this last story is about all of the various objects that have impacted Earth over the last few thousand years and how they might pose a greater danger than we thought.
Is there some new data to suggest more danger?
There is, and it actually has to do with this impact that researchers discovered a couple of years ago in the southwest corner of Egypt. There's a crater there that's about 45 meters wide that's called the Kamil Crater. And researchers first started studying it about a year ago. They found it actually during a Google Earth survey. It was big enough to be detected on Google Earth. And when they first started analyzing it, they found a lot of fragments of the original meteorite that had caused the crater. And in this new study, what they did was they started really analyzing these fragments. They found that this was an iron meteorite and that the meteorite probably weighed about 9.1 metric tons, which means that before it actually slammed into Earth, it was probably 20 to 40 metric tons. That's because objects tend to break apart a lot when they enter our atmosphere. Now, that may seem like a big meteorite, but it's actually relatively small compared to a lot of the meteorites that have hit Earth and done a lot of damage. What's interesting about it is that the fact that the researchers found a meteorite this small that had still caused a crater. They used to think that these small meteorites just disintegrated essentially in Earth's atmosphere, means that these guys are actually hitting Earth, could be hitting Earth a lot more than scientists thought. In fact, they used to think that the proportion of these objects that actually would strike Earth was only about one quarter of them would actually strike Earth. Now with this new find, they're saying as many as a third of these objects actually might not disintegrate in the atmosphere and strike Earth. And what that means is not only do we have to worry about all the big meteorites that might hit us, we have to worry about these small ones as well, because the atmosphere may not protect us as well as we thought.
So the more craters you find, the statistical probability goes up even more.
Exactly, especially the more craters you find associated with these small meteorites, because we already knew these big meteorites could cause craters because they were obviously hitting the Earth, but we didn't know that with the small ones. So if we start to find a lot of these small craters, which we might do with Google Earth and with other techniques, scientists could find out it may even be more than a third of these meteorites are actually hitting Earth, which would mean the sky is falling even more than we thought before.
But still, the occurrence of a meteorite actually striking Earth is incredibly rare.
It is very rare. And so even though these researchers are upping the odds that one of these things is going to hit us and do some damage, the odds of it hitting us in the first place is still very, very small.
Okay. Whew. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about new insights into how the Grand Canyon was formed and also some new insights into prostate cancer. Researchers have completed the prostate cancer genome, and that's telling them a lot about how this disease progresses and potentially even new ways to treat it. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we're going to take an in-depth look at the budget for science agencies. A lot of new numbers are going to be released on Monday. And we're going to be tracking that very closely to figure out which agencies are most affected, what that means for researchers, what it means for funding and grants, and even the creation of new scientific centers. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the February 11th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.